Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Valley musician Mega Ran on using his and his son's experiences in his new album.
And what we can learn from the folds of saguaro flowers.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
There is much to be learned from this young man. And so I say with my family, God bless you and your family, Charlie.
The Supreme Court decided that profiling people is like a fair thing for the government to do. Pulling them over because of how they look or how they sound and questioning them.
We're facing a tough budget year and with a lot of uncertainty coming from the federal government, and we want to act responsibly and ensure that we're safeguarding taxpayer dollars and not increasing budgets to a level that's not sustainable.
There is no promise this is going to return to the council. This is an epically important item for this city council. I'm stunned right now and speechless that this is where we are.
It's outrageous that a spokesperson for the Scottsdale Unified School District should be making disparaging remarks about the employees and people who are really trying to help the health of our student population.
You hear people use the term transparency, and they say we got to have more transparency in the political process. But the answer to that is that transparency is for the government. Privacy is for people.
And with me to talk about the Scottsdale City Council punting on a decision about whether to state, another potential ethics complaint at the state capitol, and more, are Paul Bentz of High Ground. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
And Don Penich of Agave Strategies. Don, good morning to you.
You too.
So, guys, we have to start with, of course, the biggest story of the week, the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. And there's going to be a lot. There has been a lot already this morning. We heard from the governor of Utah that they have a suspect in custody. I want to focus more, though. Arizona has obviously a very sad and interesting, in some ways, connection to this kind of political violence, of course, with former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords being shot many, many years ago at this point. And we seem to hear the same kinds of thoughts after these events, you know, from politicians. We have to think about how we're talking. We have to tone down the rhetoric, that kind of thing. And yet, in this case, like, Don, we saw, for example, members of Congress kind of yelling at each other, like, over a moment of silence. We have seen members of Congress from both parties still, like, saying the kinds of things that they were saying a week or 2 weeks ago. Is it possible at this point, do you think, to tone down the rhetoric in politics?
You know, I hate to start off the morning with such kind of a dark statement, but I do, and I think a lot of people do feel a level of despair around how we are functioning as a society that I haven't felt before or in a very long time. And it kind of does beg the question of where do we go from here? What does it take? What kind of reckoning does American society need to actually want to do the platitudes that feel so empty that we always hear about, you know, rising above and toning down rhetoric? I think it's true. But I agree with you. I am not in the aftermath of this most recent gun, you know, violence. I'm not seeing that out there. And I wish I could say that I know what it takes, but I don't know that anyone does.
Yeah. Well, and Paul, this, of course, follows not that far on the heels of the looting in Minnesota, where state legislators were targeted and at least one was assassinated. Like, what are we doing here?
Well, first of all, one thing to know is absolutely this was a tragedy, just like many of these other things were a tragedy. It's tragic that there was a shooting at a Colorado school the same day that doesn't hardly get any coverage, that seems to be de rigueur at this point, that we can talk about school shootings and sort of go past them and focus on other issues. That's incredibly tragic. This is a mental health issue. I don't think we'll hear Republicans say that a lot, but unfortunately, it certainly is a mental health issue in addition to a political discussion. And I think ultimately one of the things that's been said, I think that's really valid, is that this comes down to an issue of contempt. it's not even just rhetoric at this point, is that both sides hold the other in contempt. And the language surrounding that is not that we even just disagree, is that I have contempt for you. You are evil and I am righteous. And that creates a lot of this back and forth here, where you're just not even hearing the other side. And that is what makes this violence more acceptable, unfortunately, and why people see they turn this dissatisfaction into contempt. One of the things that Charlie Kirk did incredibly well, I think, is going onto these college campuses and recognizing that there was dissatisfaction among a portion of the young population about what these universities were doing, about what they were focused on, and trying to start that dialogue. And while it probably started in a good spot or in a spot that would have been helpful, it turned into, with social media and everything else, this item of celebrity, this item of contempt. They got more views, the worse they got, the more that they turned it up. And I think that's the what has happened here and why he's reaping what we're getting now.
It's so interesting because, you know, you hear stories about both, you know, here in Arizona and in Washington, D.C., about, you know, back in the day, politicians from different parties could, you know, fight like heck on the floor of whatever chamber they were in and then go have dinner together or go, you know, have a beer together in the evening, that while they disagreed about the issues, they recognized that they were all kind of members of this fairly exclusive club and, you know, at least could be friends. Like maybe some of them in, you know, in D.C. had, you know, room together or something. Donna, based on what Paul said and what we've heard elsewhere, like it just doesn't seem like that happens anymore.
No. And, you know, one of the reasons I say that this, I feel so much more dismayed this, you know, this week is because it is sowing and deepening divisions across parties who do disagree. You know, a number of elected officials and even just community groups have been canceling their events, all of their public events this week because of increased direct threats being called into their offices. And even within folks who do agree with each other, so, you know, my community on the left, right, there is disagreement over people who are pointing out the very real and targeted harm that Charlie Kirk and some of the rhetoric that he, you know, promoted has caused here in Arizona. And then there are also folks on the left saying, this kind of violence is never okay, no matter what this person had to say. And so even folks who agree with each other are now fighting. And that's what happens. Martin Luther King, right, said that violence begets violence, anger begets anger. And that's what we are seeing across the board.
Paul, speaking of not toning down rhetoric, the Arizona House Democratic Caucus this week said that they were planning to file an ethics complaint against Representative John Gillette. He's a Republican from Kingman who had some, I won't repeat them, but some pretty unkind things to say about Muslims. This is not the first sort of interim ethics complaint that we've been talking about in the state legislature since the session has ended. I'm curious what you make of not only the fact that he said these things, but then when asked by a reporter about them, he kind of doubled down on them and doesn't seem to think that there's a problem with the things that he said.
Well, it speaks to the unapologetic nature of politics. It also speaks to our, quite frankly, our legislative district system, where most people are from safe legislative districts. He's from an incredibly safe Republican district. His Republican base that elects him in the primary doesn't have a problem with that type of language. In fact, you know, they're anti-woke and they're anti all of the DEI and everything else. And they think that this sort of language reflects that and it's telling it like it is. And these people get rewarded from their base. And this happens on both sides of the aisle. This is not just a Republican issue. This is a Democrat issue where the more progressive language certainly gets them where they want to go in a lot of cases as well. But in this case, it's certainly one of those things that he says something. Most folks don't think it's okay, but then it's serving his base and then outrage. And then he gets to go back to his base and say, see, the people that we have contempt for, back to that contempt idea, disagree with me. So I must be doing something right.
Don, do you see anything coming from this?
From the ethics complaint?
Yeah,
you mean?
In the legislature?
No, probably not. We've had lots of instances of folks, maybe not particularly this exact, you know, anti-Islamic rhetoric, but we've had lots of other folks in the legislature say abhorrent things and nothing has happened, not even really a slap on the wrist. And then you put it in the context of an election year and that Republicans don't want to be beat up by the more extreme wing of the party for doing even what they know is right. No, I don't think we'll see anything come of this whatsoever.
Do you anticipate that this might have any kind of effect on like how the House works next year? No, I have no idea if Representative Gillette works with Democrats on issues or if they are looking to get him to sign on to bills or anything like that. But I wonder if, you know, the act of filing an ethics complaint, assuming that House Democrats follow through on what they say they're going to do, and the fact that this representative said what he said, like, does that affect anything?
No, and I think that, in fact, everyone is just kind of preparing themselves for what is probably going to be one of the most divided and toxic legislative sessions that we've seen in a long time, which, if you know, the Arizona legislature is really saying so, you know. Gird yourself. It's going to be a tough ride next year.
Right. I think we're going to see a lot of political theater next year. I think
in an election year,
Come on.
You
know, yeah, I know. It's hard to predict. I mean, the budget discussion was already pretty negative and nasty this year. I think it will be even worse. I think the Republicans will bring forth a lot of the similar bills that they have in the past to try to make and score political points in the this midterm election. This midterm election should benefit Republicans. They overperformed in the 2024 election by a lot. There was a lack of Democratic enthusiasm. In the midterms, Republicans do even better typically in the state. With the exception of 2022, Republicans have dominated midterms, and I think they're looking to do that again this year. So I think that type of rhetoric, the type of bills that they're going to bring forth are all reflective of their strategy to put the governor in a tough spot, to put their Democratic opponents in a tough spot, and try to gain seats in some of these critical swing districts. You know, Republicans they went from a one-vote majority to a larger majority in both chambers. I think they're going to try to increase that this year as well, or next year as well.
Guys, let's talk about the Scottsdale City Council. They were under a lot of pressure, it seems, to vote. It's kind of a convoluted story here, but basically, there were a number of people in Scottsdale who wanted the council to vote to sue the state over a law that stopped an election over a decision that a previous council had made. And if you can follow all that, you're a better person than I. Don, I'm curious what you make of the fact that the city council basically tabled it. They didn't say yes. They didn't say no. They just kind of said, not right now.
Yeah, well, I think they're just trying to prolong what is a bit of a dumpster fire politically, and just kind of kick the can down the road. You know, ultimately, and Scottsdale itself and many powerful interests within Scottsdale and the state level are really torn over this. Here's this massive employer,
Axon,
who wants to do a lot of development, you know, a high-end hotel, which is something that the current Scottsdale leadership really likes, but also apartments, which the current Scottsdale leadership has said they do not want any more apartments, no matter what the housing situation is in Arizona. But there's 5,500 jobs that would be turning away. Axon themselves have said that they've never seen a more toxic negotiation process. So it's kind of a no-win situation that I think they just decided they don't want to tackle right now, but it's not going away. And there are very strong feelings. And what's also true is that the state has very clear authority to do exactly what they did.
Well, and Paul, it's interesting. As Don said, this issue is not going away. The people who are anti the development have made that pretty clear. So theoretically, at some point, the council is going to have to take a stand on this. I wonder, like, does it make it harder to do that when you've already sort of punted on it once?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a challenging issue. You've got this large economic driver that is probably one of the most known national brands that we have in Arizona. Axon's the producer of Taser, for those who don't know. And in addition to that, you know, Scottsdale has a long history of there being an anti-growth crowd that is also transformed into a little bit of an anti-apartment crowd and sort of a not-in-my-backyard crowd that is very vocal and has been very influential over the years. And so you've got this conflict. They're tabling the issue right now. I think there are some more. One of the articles I read talked about that there's more legal maneuvering and part of that, and that the city's also hoping maybe to bring back to the table to do some negotiation. Back to our original point about political dialogue, negotiation, compromise, finding a way to work together. I think there's a way to make this a win-win, hopefully. I mean, we want to keep these jobs here in Arizona, but we also want the people in the community to be happy as well. And so, you know, you would look at those individuals, and we're not a part of that, but just say, hey, maybe we can find a way to compromise and come out with something that's good for both sides.
Do you think the ship has sailed on negotiation, on coming up with a compromise?
from what I read in one of the articles, it sounds like maybe, but I mean, there's always never say never. I mean, certainly back to what Dom was talking about, Martin Luther King, I say the world misses a John McCain right now. We need more statesmen. We need more people who are convening forces that bring people together and want to find solutions to issues instead of just scoring political points.
Don, do you think it's possible that they can come up with a compromise that everybody can at least live with?
I think so. I think at least this signals to me that by putting this off, that they actually are reopening the door to start conversations that had really, you know, crashed earlier.
So, guys, one of you had mentioned the budget for next year just a moment or two ago, and Governor Hobbs is basically signaling to state agencies and seemingly everyone else, this is not going to be a great budget year coming up. The state is poised to lose a decent amount of money based on the federal the tax cut law that Congress passed recently and President Trump signed into law. So given that it's an election year, Don, given that, as you both have talked about, how it might not be the most pleasant legislative session, now we're throwing into it, you know, state agencies, what, like a 2% increase and that's it? Really no money for anything else. What does that mean for the session and for the budget, do you think?
Well, if there's the silver lining to this, hopefully it means that it's a short session, which when you have less money to fight over and you have less to negotiate with, and it's an election year and people want to be out knocking doors and talking to their voters, it might mean that it's ugly and dirty, but we get out of there quickly. And, you know, there are a lot of factors. We knew as a state that we were going to be looking at, you know, a bad budget. Then the federal, you know, decisions have piled onto that. And so there's only so much that the legislature can do. And when your hands are tied, there's really no reason to stick around.
Yeah, Paul, sort of the conventional wisdom is when there's no money, you just say no to everybody and then you kind of move on, right?
Right. Well, we were not going to see the Oprah budget where you get a special project and you get a special project and the rodeo gets a special project. I think we're going to definitely see less of that. I also suspect that the Republicans will start by offering a budget similar to that they did in the past, where it's either a maintenance budget or even a cut. I would not be surprised if Republicans came forth with a cut to start to try to, you know, balance the budget and right the ship. But we'll see. It'll definitely be a tough negotiation, and we'll see sort of where it ends up. The other thing, in addition to the federal tax cut, I mean, I think it's important to note that the legislature removed the rental tax, and the rental tax has harmed the cities as well. So not only is the state going to be suffering, but there's many cities out there that have lost significant revenue from what the rental tax is, and they're struggling with that as well. And so I think that's part of the ongoing discussion as well, is what does the municipalities look like? So it's not only from the state level, but I think we'll see a trickle-down effect in the cities as well.
How big – I mean, the budget obviously is sort of the elephant in the room for much of the session until the very end. I wonder, though, given what you both have talked about, all of the issues, maybe Republicans trying to put Democrats in a tough spot, the governor trying to put Republicans in a tough spot, where do you think the budget will be in terms of like the issue or the important issues of the session? Paul, what do you think?
I mean, certainly always comes down to public safety and education. I think housing is going to be another big one that they'll try to use that as a bargaining chip. And you know, every year we seem to try to do something regarding housing. I think those are sort of the bigger issues here. But I think Republicans are going to try to use, you know, immigration issues are still big for them and still the number one issue among Republicans. So I suspect that they'll try to use some version or some collection of immigration bills to try to negotiate or drive the discussion as well.
Don, what do you think?
Well, I think Democrats will, you know, have an obligation and will be looking at the voucher program, the private school voucher program, which is well over $1 billion at this point. Every week we see new headlines about the waste, fraud, and abuse that program is marked by. And, you know, every dollar that's going toward someone's, you know, private wardrobe, let's say, and trips to Disneyland and everything else is a dollar that we don't have for public schools, but for many other, you know, negotiating needs that the state has as well. And so Democrats will be looking at that. And I think where we'll eventually get is just kind of the status quo. Like, you know, Republicans will have their cuts to programs that they have contempt for, to use Paul's really accurate language. And in the end, the governor will protect those things, and then we'll just kind of we'll move forward with nothing extra.
Interesting. All right, guys, just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about a former state lawmaker, Justine Watzak, was involved in a court case in southern Arizona over a traffic stop she had a few years back while she was in the legislature. She was not issued a ticket then at the time because the legislature was in session. She was then issued a ticket later. She filed a pretty big lawsuit claiming all sorts of civil rights violations and things like that. And, Paul, she was seemingly almost to be held in contempt of court for not showing up to a hearing. And this week she said she was dropping the case. I wonder, though, because there had been rumors that Senator Watzak might be looking to make a play to come back to the legislature. Does all this impact that at all, do you think?
Well, I certainly think behavior, that's one of the contributing factors. The speeding ticket and using her influence was part of it. I think there's other items that fell into that that certainly made her lose that primary last year. The person she ran against has now announced that he is not going to run for re-election, Senator Leach. I think certainly with that open seat, it would be very tempting for her to jump in. Rhetorically, she's been among the MAGA folks with the way that she's addressed these issues. I think she approached the lawsuit in a similar manner. But one of the things that we do find with Republicans is when the rubber hits the road, when there's actual legal ramifications, whether it's denying the election or whether it's denying a speeding ticket, whether it's when the actual law comes to call, then they sort of change their tune a little bit or at least lighten up. But before, until that point, rhetorically, you know, they're fighting the man and they're standing up because, you know, they think it's the right thing to do.
Dawn, do you think this impacts her political future, this whole incident?
I think that she had a lot of kind of negative baggage around her. You know, she's very much, like Paul was indicating, someone who plays and profits off of the most extreme rhetoric and, you know, riling folks up. So she had a lot of baggage around her. This kind of thing doesn't help. I mean, anytime we see her name, it's for something negative. And in her, even in that district, voters don't like that. That's why they didn't have her back the first time.
All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Dawn Penich, Paul Bentz, thanks to you guys both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a local rapper continues making songs for children, and as his son grows up, so do the themes in his newest album.
But first, for many of us, the iconic saguaro is practically synonymous with our state. We all know the cactus thrives in the summer heat, as we all strive to do. Yet the full biology of the saguaro is still a relatively new field of study. In recent years, scientists have started taking a closer look at saguaro cactus blossoms, small flowers that grow on the surface of the cactus. What can we learn from these vibrant blooms, and why are they so difficult to monitor? High Country News recently explored these questions in a piece called Counting Flowers to Read the Saguaro's Future, and I spoke with the author of that piece, Shian Kim, about what makes the flowers so captivating.
They honestly remind me of a fried egg because they have a yellow heart and pearly white petals. They're really big. They're like medallion-sized, and they usually bloom all around the crown of the saguaro and deck the tips of the limbs of the cactus.
Wow, that's a beautiful description.
Thank you.
So one of the other things that's interesting about these flowers, right, is that they bloom pretty well into the saguaro's life cycle, correct?
Yes. Actually, they only start blooming when a saguaro is about 35 years old, which is quite late, but maybe not so late considering the whole lifespan of the saguaro. The cactus can live up to 200 years old.
Okay. So if I'm not mistaken, one of the reasons that scientists are looking more closely at saguaro flowers recently is because about, what, like 15 years ago or so, they started to disappear.
It's a bit of a complex picture. The scientists who started looking into the flowering patterns were just simply curious about them, and no one had tracked these flowers before. So it's easy to assume that they're either declining or erupting more than usual. But someone needed to actually keep track of these flowers year to year, basically.
Oh, interesting. I see. So what if they had not previously been looked at very closely, the saguaro flowers, what made scientists start to get interested in them?
simply because they're cool looking. Anyone who goes into the desert can't miss them. So, and it's easy to start asking questions about these flowers. When I talked to one source who worked for the National Park Service at one point as a ranger, and he told me the visitors would always have questions about the flowers when they visited in April, May. And these are just basic questions like, oh, how many flowers bloom on the cactus? What are they for? And for many of those questions, especially when it comes to count, at first the scientists had no answer for. And it sounds like such a basic question that really triggered research into this topic. But then the more researchers are studying these flowers, the more they realize, even after 15 years, scientists still don't have many of the answers to these questions.
As scientists have started to look more closely at flowers, they seem to contain a larger story about the ecosystem of the desert.
Absolutely. There was this one experiment of researchers looking into the bits of DNA from other animals around these flowers. It's called eDNA, environmental DNA. And swallow flowers actually sustain a whole food chain. The flowers attract over 100 species of animals to feed on the nectar and pollen. And those birds and insects are in turn predated on by other birds. There's a whole food chain that's being sustained by these flowers.
Yes. And one of the other insights that I gather has come out of this newly intensive study of the flowers is their growth pattern, right?
Yes. So in 2021, there was a massive super bloom event. Many, even residents, noticed that the swallows in their backyards or on the street seemed to be erupting in flowers, producing flowers, not just on the tips of their limbs or on their heads, but also all down their torsos and their hips. And scientists do think that this could be a sign of extreme heat, just because it does correlate with the long-term weather patterns. But the jury's still out whether this is necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. Flowers are the start of producing the seeds that would eventually become swallows. So the more flowers you produce could be a good thing in terms of like potentially trying to grow more seeds and produce more progeny, basically. But it could also be a sign of something massively going awry in the environment.
Speaking of the scientists, one of the projects that is looking at this is called Flower Power, which is a great name. Tell us a little bit about the Flower Power project.
So these scientists, along with several volunteers, are taking photos of these swallows with 30-foot-long selfie sticks, and then having these records of these photos of these flowers saved in an archive so they can keep coming back to the data and ask new questions from this big archive of images, basically.
Yes, in your piece, you have there are these wonderful pictures of the scientists with the giant selfie stick standing next to the swallows. It's kind of a funny image. But as a result of that, it seems like we are able to see these extreme close-ups of these flowers about which so little is known, and kind of start to understand them for the first time.
Yes, exactly. It's really hard to monitor these swallow flowers because they're also so tall. Some scientists have been trying to use binoculars or climbing onto like up the hill if they're on a slope just to look down at the flowers to make sure they've counted it correctly. But the selfie stick, it's ingenious, I think.
Yes. Well, and it's also so funny to me that, you know, the saguaro cactus blossom is the state's official flower, and yet we know so little about it.
Yes. It takes a lot of patience. It's not easy to study the saguaro in general because they live so long, and scientists have less than a century worth of data when it comes to just the saguaro itself. And these plants live over 200 years, so it's hard to come up with anything definite to say about the swallows if you haven't observed a single swallow over its entire full natural lifetime.
One other thing, Kim, that I realize we should add here is that we're talking about the study of these flowers being a recent phenomenon in one sense, but as you point out in your piece, the Tohono O'odham have been observing these flowers for many generations, correct?
It depends on what you mean by observing. They haven't been like keeping track of the flowers or studying the flowers themselves, but of course they respect the sowars themselves. They're regarded as like they have their own agency basically. But yeah, one source I spoke with says that whenever she sees the flowers, she starts to anticipate the arrival of the blood red fruit it produces. So in a way, those flowers herald that tradition as well as herald the Tohono O'odham New Year that begins with the fruit harvesting. So I guess when you start seeing the flowers, you have something to look forward to in this tangible thing of beauty that's embodied by the flower.
Well, Shien Kim is a climate and science fellow at High Country News and wrote this lovely piece called Counting Flowers to Read the Saguaro's Future. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. The Arrangement is, in a lot of ways, a lot like other romantic comedies. Two mothers try to set up their adult but still single children, hoping they'll hit it off. It's the start of what will be an arranged marriage. There's a language barrier, and comedy ensues. But there's one way in which it's not at all like other romantic comedies. It's almost entirely in the Navajo language. The project began with a grant from the Navajo Nation Film Office, which required them to use at least 80% Navajo in the film. It was an attempt to breathe new life into the dying language. And for filmmaker Shoni De La Rosa, it was a challenge. As he told our co-host Lauren Gilger, arranged marriages were quite common on the Navajo Nation throughout its history, and it turns out they're not unheard of today.
I've actually got two friends of mine that were in arranged marriage. I didn't know that.
Wow.
For the longest time, till one day one of them told me, and I was like, oh, wow. You know, and all kinds of questions popped into my head because I never met anybody that was in an arranged marriage. And then I'd say a couple of years later, another friend of mine in conversation said that he was in an arranged marriage as well. You know, so questions were abound, you know. I mean, you know, anybody would have a lot of questions, you know. I was like, what was it like? Did you know her? How did you feel? Were you scared? Things like that. And, you know, and when I was a young man, my grandmother, my late grandmother, used to tease me a lot about marrying me off. She told me a lot about arranged marriages and why they were and, you know, how common they were back in the day. Even in her days, they were quite common.
So maybe still a little more common today than even you realized, it sounds like, if you know two
possibly,
friends.
Possibly, yeah. Possibly could be, yeah.
You know? It sounds like you picked their brains to try to, you know, do some research for this film, writing the script, et cetera. What did they tell you about how this came to be and how they felt about being in an arranged marriage today?
One friend of mine, I asked him, you know, I said, you know, did you know her? And he says, yeah, I went to school with her. But never in a million years did I think I'd ever marry her. I just remember her being kind of mean, you know. But on the day, wedding day came, she came walking in. I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to marry her, you know. So they've had a long lasting relationship. I've been married with my wife for about 38 years. Last month was our wedding anniversary.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah. So my friends, their marriages have lasted just as long, their arranged marriages. But the idea for the movie just kind of popped into my head. I guess the catalyst for it was my wife. She likes to watch those Korean rom-coms on Netflix. And I kind of get pulled into that with her. And one day she said, maybe you should try to make something like that, you know? Yeah. And I was like, oh, we'll see, you know? And then one day this idea popped into my head. Maybe I'll try making a romantic comedy, but of what? And then when I just thought, why not do it about an arranged marriage?
Okay, so let's talk about the use of the Navajo language in this movie, because it's mostly in Navajo, and that's a big part of the plot line, right? Because in this arranged marriage, Harold here is introduced to Rita, who doesn't really speak any English, right? She only speaks in Navajo. And I know this movie began with a grant from the Navajo Nation Film Office to write and produce a short film using at least 80% Navajo in the film. This obviously became a little longer than that. But talk a little bit about approaching a film mostly using this language.
I personally am not a Navajo speaker. I don't speak fluent Navajo. I speak just tiny little bits and fragments of it. But I've been around it the vast majority of my life, and I kind of know how Navajo is delivered. I understand more of the language than I can speak it. Mm-hmm. Navajo is a very powerful language. It's very descriptive. Things that are said in Navajo just seem to hit a lot different than if you were to say it in English. Hmm. So having it done in Navajo, and when people watch the movie that speak and understand Navajo, it's going to hit good, you know? It's going to hit good.
I mean, there's something really profound about that, right? Because the Navajo language is being lost rapidly. And it seems like that's probably part of what this effort was about from the Navajo Nation Film Office, to try to preserve this language. But what did it mean to you personally? Like, you said you yourself don't even know the language fluently.
Yeah, when I was young, let's go back when I was 18, 19, 20 years old. I live here on the Navajo Nation, and I remember back then almost everybody spoke Navajo.
Yeah.
Everywhere you went, everybody spoke Navajo. And nowadays, it's like hardly anybody speaks Navajo. It's our language is slowly dying. I think bringing back the language and showing how beautiful and powerful and strong it is really important. The lead character in the film, he speaks Navajo, but it's not very good as the character in the story. And his mother's pressuring him to speak Navajo, use it more. And when he goes over to his, you know, soon-to-be bride's home to go through the in-law test, they only speak Navajo there. So he's forced to speak Navajo the best he can, and yet they correct him, you know, and he gets better and better at it, you know. But, you know, it's like me, when I try to speak some words in Navajo, I'll butcher it really, really bad, and I'll say something completely wrong or completely appalling. And that's also depicted in the film as well.
There seems to be a common kind of cultural tension there, right, in this generation of people trying to speak this language they're not incredibly fluent in. I wonder, you talked about the power of the Navajo language and trying to convey that, but this is a romantic comedy, right? So it's interesting because it's kind of this modern film genre, and I wonder what you thought about trying to use Navajo in that way. Like, you're also trying to show that it's funny.
Yeah, well, the film takes place in modern times. I don't have a single cell phone in any of the shots. I don't have a TV, nothing. It's because this is like out in the middle of nowhere on the Navajo Nation. And, you know, most people tend to just listen to the radio, work, take care of their sheep, their homestead, things like that, you know. And so I kind of wanted to show that a lot of our lives these days are consumed with technology, you know, especially social media. And I didn't want to really depict any of that in the film. Kind of wanted to depict it that way along with Navajo, you know, and show the importance of the language, respecting your elders and being a hard worker, you know, things like that. You know, and it's kind of some of the messages that are in the film, you know. And it's like I said, it's a romantic comedy. It's something I have never done in my life ever. A lot of my past works are shock and awe and satire and things like that, you know. But all of us were really proud of what we did. You know, we're real happy that everybody enjoys the movie. And it is subtitled in English, so you don't have to be a Navajo speaker or understand Navajo in order to watch and understand the movie. But it is a lot better if you understand Navajo.
Fair enough. All right. We will leave it there. That is Shoni De La Rosa, the writer, producer, and director of the film The Arrangement, owner of Sheephead Films, joining us. Shoni, thank you for coming on and telling us about this, and congrats on the film. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Phoenix musician Raheem Jarbo, a.k.a. Megaran, can be described in a lot of ways. In fact, the adjectives listed on his website include teacher, rapper, father, and author. He's out with his second album of children's music called Buddy's Magic Treehouse. It's up to his debut kids album called Buddy's Magic Toy Box. The music is inspired by his son, and when he came by the studio recently, I asked him to explain that inspiration.
Well, I thought, like, if the toy box was just, like, exploring all the different things you can play with and the different ways you can enjoy play, the treehouse is as you grow up a little more and you may want a little bit of maybe alone time or representing a safe space. And me growing up in Philadelphia, we didn't have a treehouse. But the treehouse represented a bit of safety, like a bit of a getaway. you know, where you can get up there and you're by yourself and you can get into your own imagination and have fun. And so that's what I kind of wanted to reminisce on. And as this kid grows up, I ultimately want these albums to grow up with him. Mm. And so I'm like, well, let's just talk about now, like, how to make good friends, like taking your healthy habits and bringing them to the next level and things like that.
Did you find that you drew from your own childhood, despite your lack of an actual treehouse growing up? Did you take from your experience? Are you taking from your son's experience that you've observed so far?
A lot of both. Most of the songs are inspired by conversations that we've had, for sure.
Okay.
We'll talk about a thing, or let's say I have a song about brushing your teeth because he doesn't like to brush his teeth. Here's how to remove plaque. Got a brush and floss after meals and snacks. Gentle when you enter. That's what the method is. But get into the pits and the crevices. Look in the mirror while you do it. Yeah, I know you might look a little foolish. That's why I made this tune for you to groove with. Move that brush while you move to the music. Brush them teeth. Brush them teeth. Brush the brush them teeth. I'm like, well, maybe if I put it to some, you know, catchy beat, you know, this will make them get excited about it.
Does that help?
A little bit. Okay. Not much. It's a 50-50. You know, I say, do you need me to put the song on? And he's like, yes, put the song on. And so then I'll put it on and it makes it a little easier. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the song called Dino Stomp on the Playground. Dino Stomp on the Playground. Ground's gonna shake. Everybody move like a prehistoric quake. Velociraptor pack trying to get on a slide. You got to take turns. You're one at a time. And I'm curious both about sort of the music and the lyrics here, because musically, this seems like a little bit of a departure for you in terms of genre. It's got some horns in it, more of a guitar beat than what we're used to hearing from your music. Are you consciously trying to maybe experiment with different genres of music?
Yes, absolutely. Even with the first album, we did a little bit of experimentation with some ska, some rock, you know, live instrumentation. There's horns on probably 70% of the first album. And I wanted to continue that, the live instrumentation stuff, and playing so many shows and playing with bands and playing with live musicians just really gives these songs a whole new life. And I just thought, man, if I could just capture a little bit of that feeling on a recording. And so basically I built a makeshift band for Dino Stomp. And that just basically came from taking all the things that my kid loves. You know, he loves going to the playground and he loves dinosaurs. And so I was like, well, how many of his favorite dinos can I mention? And imagine if they were all on our playground, like as we were going to play, you know. So it's a wild song. It's probably my favorite on the record. And it's really what inspired the rest of the album. I can remember maybe 9-10 months ago where I didn't have a lot of ideas. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And then this song came first. That might work in the land before time, but over here we take our turn and we ask permission. So you use the park today, and maybe I use the park tomorrow. All right, good talk. I'm out. Let me ask you about another song on this album called Love That Guy. And this kind of goes back to what you were talking about in terms of understanding sort of who you are and sort of being comfortable in your own skin. This seemed more like a message almost to your son and probably to other kids and other adults as well, that the message seems to be, look, you are who you are and that's fine. Didn't recognize it then, but I was shrinking myself, being something I wasn't to please everyone else. But now I look in the mirror like I love that guy. Man, I wish I was that guy. If he was here, I would hug that guy. I wonder if he knows that I love that guy. Because truthfully, I didn't always love that guy. Love That Guy is one of my favorites. I got to thank 123 Andres, who helped me out with that. They're an amazing duo, a bilingual duo, that won a Grammy last year for Best Children's Album. And we just wanted to talk about self-love and, you know, just appreciating who you are. And, you know, I think I've read a quote somewhere where someone said, just be you and they'll adjust. And that's something I'm like, wow, if like 7-year-old me could have heard and understood that, you know, I might be in a different place right now. And yeah, this was something that was mostly autobiographical. It was me telling my own story and how, like, talking about the idea of building a representative, because you're just maybe like ashamed of who you are or what people might say about you. So you try to pretend to be a little cooler than you actually are. And then you realize, like, wow, later on in life, you're like, well, I wasn't being my true self, and this isn't fun. You know, it's so much more fun to be yourself. You know, like, fitting in isn't fun at all. Like, why not just stand out? And that's always been kind of a Mega Ran message throughout my music. Hmm. But I wanted to make sure that this was one that kids could relate to and understand. And what better way than just, hey, look in the mirror and realize that I love that guy or I love that girl. Like, you're okay, you know?
Do you consciously try to balance sort of the fun songs with the message songs when you're writing kids' music?
No, it just kind of happens that way, I think. You know? I want them to be fun, but I try to do both, you know.
Even the message songs are fun.
I try to make
some
sure.
Some seem like pure fun.
Yes.
Whereas others are more like thinkers, maybe.
That's a good point. I think maybe it's not a really fully conscious thing, but when I made the first album, Toy Box, I remember my only goal was if the song made me smile, then it was a keeper. This time I expanded a little bit where, yes, I probably was thinking like, all right, well, this song is going to maybe be about some positive values, but this song is going to be complete silliness and foolishness. And so, I think the balance is important. And so I think just trying to combine the medicine with the candy, as they say, is probably the teacher in me. So it's probably subconsciously happening.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about how you want the albums as they come out to sort of grow with your son. This one, it seems like it kind of does that because, of course, you know, when kids are really, really little, it's all play, right? Like eat, sleep, and play is basically what you do. But as you start to get older, you know, there's school that comes up. There are more, you know, lessons, social interactions that come up. It seems like even if it was subconscious, like this is really growing with your son.
Even almost track to track. I feel like, you know, as we get to the end, it starts to feel like it grows up. You know, there's a song on there that's probably the most maybe like touching song I've ever done when it comes to like family music is Why Do People Go? Where myself and Kimya Dawson, we talk about loss. And how to deal with it and how it affects you.
Why do people go? I really wanna know. It's like they're here 1 second and then they're gone the next one. And I don't really seem to understand. Why do people go?
It's a song that I was a little afraid to put out because it's not the normal jovial Mega Ran song. But it is something that people have to deal with, whether it's, you know, friends leaving, moving away. You know, I can still recall like one of my best friends moved away when I was in second grade and like crushed me. You know what I mean? And even to the point where we had some kids on there singing. And when I asked the parent of the kids to do this, she's like, yes, I can get them to sing on this. But I have to know, Mega Ran, like, what's the resolution? You know, my kids are asking me, you know, like, What is the resolution that we need to get at from this? And so I had to explain to them the concept of the song is that, yes, people do grow. People move on. People are in our lives for a moment. But it's important to cherish those friendships and those moments and make the most of them.
All right. That is Raheem Jarbo, also known as Mega Ran. His second children's album is called Buddy's Magic Treehouse. Raheem, so nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And if you would like to see Mega Ran perform live and in person, you can do so on Sunday. Get your tickets for Sunday afternoon to see the show live on stage at Crescent Ballroom. Mega Ran will be among those who is there. Just go to rsvp.kjzz.org for all the deets. Get your tickets. I do hope to see you today. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. As always, thanks so much for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to see you on Sunday. If not, we'll have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.